Barely Research Facts is a fact-based podcast brought to you by Art Now Das, an experiential arts agency based out of Mumbai. Each week, we pick a word at random, dive into it, and see what it brings to us. We are your hosts. My name is Ragini, and this is Shar. Let's go.
Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Barely Research Facts. You're here with me, Shar and Ragini.
Hi, guys.
And the word for today is fairy tale.
I loved it.
I did too. And there's so much to dig into. So let's start.
I know. Let's jump in.
So the first thing that I thought of when talking about fairy tales is, how do you distinguish them from myths, legends, folk tales, all of these other things that are so similar, but, you know, just slightly different? And from all the stuff that I've read, the main difference is that they usually have a magical element to them, which obviously is our favorite bit. The fairy tale, the wonder tale, the magic tale, the fairy story, or the Märchen, whatever you want to call it, it's usually a short story and it features mythical entities like dwarves, dragons, elves, fairies, giants, gnomes, much more. All the stuff that I loved growing up.
I love the term wonder stories. I did not know that.
I feel like it could be German. It could have been a direct translation from German.
Yeah. I think we can start a petition at the end of this to change the word fairy tales in colloquial use to wonder tales. Wonder stories.
Sorry. Oh, yeah, wonder stories. So in most cultures, there's no clear line separating myth from folk or fairy tale. And they together form the literature of the pre-literate societies. Now, what this basically means is that they've been around ages, thousands of years before we started to write down all the oral traditions and histories and stories that we told. Whether these stories started out as, you know, plays, or whether they were acted, they were danced by the people who initially came up with them, they've been handed down from one generation to the next, and which obviously were popularized by the Grimm brothers, who consolidated all of it, put their own spin on all of them, and released them into the public. And that's what we know as the fairy tale in modern society. We will talk a little later in the episode about how old these stories exactly are and a couple of guesstimates on on how old they are and how people got to this idea.
Yeah, so I know you have that, but also just coming back a bit, when we talk about fairy tales, there's so much of, you know, we know about the Grimm brothers, we know about, there's a heavily westernized context to fairy tales.
Yeah.
But also one of the first things that kind of came to my mind when I was thinking about, like, you know, when I was doing my research was, you know, Indian fairy tales. And then obviously, you know, you come up, you know, the Panchatantra.
Yeah.
Which all of us have grown up in India. You know, for context, the Panchatantra is an ancient Indian collection of interrelated animal fables in Sanskrit.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily, it was written in Sanskrit at the time. And the oldest surviving work is roughly dated back to between 200 BCE to 300 CE.
Mm.
So, right. So this is the written work. And it, of course, the written work is based on a much older oral tradition.
Mm.
The manner of how it's been passed on from generation to generation stays pretty much the same across cultures, whether it's in the West or in the East.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually, I will come down in later in the segment, like, I will talk to you about just how the Panchatantra has actually influenced fairy tales in some way globally.
Wow.
Which is really interesting because I didn't know that before. There is a section in the Panchatantra that identifies the author as an octogenarian Brahmin named Vishnu Sharma. However, there is a lot of conjecture about whether this is really his name or whether it was a pen name. And mostly scholars now agree that this was possibly a literary invention and not really a real person.
Mm-hmm.
So, and while the text is now known as the Panchatantra, there is an old manuscript, like older versions of the Panchatantra have titles that have various names. So most of those names end in Akhayayika or Akhayanika, which mean little story or little story book, respectively, in Sanskrit.
Oh, cute.
Now, the fables of the Panchatantra are found in numerous world languages. It is also considered partly the origin of European secondary work. A lot of folktale motifs that you also find in the works of the Grimm brothers are motifs that have actually been derived from the Panchatantra into, you know...
What?
Yeah, into folk stories and fairy stories that actually kind of permeated down as we sort of moved along in time. So the hypothesis initially that started kind of going around after this was that a lot of popular worldwide animal-based fables were based on the Panchatantra. But that has kind of been disputed now because... The thing is that, you know, the storylines are kind of similar, but that could just have to do with the fact that human morals and values and the things that make people feel good or, the things that people consider good are largely the same globally.
Mm.
And so each culture could have had its own stories. And then, you know, it's sort of the overall theme kind of becomes similar. And so actually, you know, it could be that oral traditions in different parts of the world gave birth to their respective story, like stories in those cultures. But the themes have just stayed the same because that's just what appeals to human beings globally.
Yeah.
So in the Indian tradition, the Panchatantra is what they call a Niti Shastra.
Okay.
A Niti is sort of translated to the wise conduct of life. And Shastra is, you know, it's a technical or scientific treatise. And so therefore, this is actually, the Panchatantra is actually a scientific treatise on the wise conduct of life. So again, you know, that's why it passes down morals, it passes down, you know, values.
Mm.
There are some particular, you know, characters that are based, even in Western traditions, that are based on Indian sages from the Panchatantra itself.
Okay.
The names that I read were Bijpai and Pilpay the sage. Both of whom I haven't really heard of, but apparently these are characters that have been, in time later on, translated into Elizabethan English back in 1570, actually.
Wow.
And there was a book called The Fables of Bijpai.
I'm not surprised. Like, at the time, if you go traveling, you know, to a quote-unquote faraway land, and there's these folk tales that are, you know, amazing, mythical, and fantastical, I would definitely translate them the best I could and show it to the queen, I guess, and be like, okay, where's my land and where's my title?
Actually, there were some people who did this. To just journey through, you know, how the Panchatantra kind of like dispersed to different parts of the world, it's very clear now with research that the Panchatantra was not the original, you know, fairy tale, folk story, whatever.
Mm.
Every culture had its versions of it. However, the Panchatantra is the first ever work to be written down for children. And in this itself, it sort of really goes to show you what the influence of the Panchatantra has been to stories for children across the world.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know, and I thought it was quite like interesting. Mm. Currently, fables of the Panchatantra are known in at least 38 languages around the world in 112 versions.
What?
Scholars have noted a strong similarity between stories in the Panchatantra and Aesop's fables, and Panchatantra is also the origin of several stories in Arabian Nights, Sinbad the Sailor, many other Western nursery rhymes and ballads. It's really spread its way across the world.
Yeah.
There are also lots of stories that it shares in common with the Buddhist Jataka tales.
Mm, Jataka tales I've read also, yeah. Is that something that you read when you were a kid as well?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether the fairy tales of like Arabian Nights, I'm guessing, is fairly popular, but like whether Panchatantra and Jataka tales and all were really popular outside of the East, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think that for a lot of us who grew up here, it's been, you know, it's something that we really read at and influenced by, I guess.
Mm.
You know, it's very clear that the Jataka tales were not invented by the Buddhists, but it's very uncertain about where the origin is and whether they've really actually borrowed stories from the Panchatantra or the Mahabharata also, for that matter.
Yeah.
But there is sort of a tapping into a common
source,
tapestry of, you know, tales. Yeah. All of it sort of seemed to come from ancient India.
Yeah.
So that has occurred. It is likely that Buddhist monks on pilgrimage to India took the text to, you know, sort of travel with the text north to Tibet and China, east to Southeast Asia. And all of these led to versions in, you know, across the East in terms of like, you know, different stories that came through Tibetan and Chinese, Mongolian, Javanese, and lots of other derivatives.
Yeah.
Panchatantra also migrated to the Middle East. And this is a really interesting story.
Okay.
About how it went from India to Iran. During the reign of Anushiravan in around 550 CE, his physician at the time, Burzuwa, told the story of, you know, went to his king and asked his permission to make a trip to Hindustan. You know, he'd heard of this mountain herb that when mingled into a compound and sprinkled over a corpse, it restored life to a corpse.
Ooh.
Yeah. And so when he came to India, he was told by, you know, he went looking for it and there was a wise sage who told him that while this herb does not really exist, what he told him was that the herb is the scientist. Science is the mountain everlastingly out of reach of the multitude. The corpse is the man without knowledge. And for the uninstructed, man is everywhere lifeless. Through knowledge, man becomes revivified. And then the sage pointed to the book. Yeah, and then basically that's how the physician went ahead and translated the work into Arabic.
Okay.
Into not Arabic, into Pahlavi, which is a Middle Eastern language.
Okay.
With some of the, you know, some of the Brahmins that helped him. In 570 CE, his translation was then translated into Syriac. And nearly two centuries later, it was translated into Arabic by Ibn al-Mukaffa in around 750 CE. This translation has considered one of the first masterpieces of Arabic literary prose, and almost all of pre-modern European translations of the Panchatantra arise from this Arabic version.
Wow.
Yeah, it's had a really fascinating journey. I mean, like, just to see how different people have accessed it and then like translated it, and you know, how it's adapted itself to different cultures around the world is quite an amazing testimony to the quality of the text as well.
Also, do you think that if you traveled thousands of kilometers and in search of something, and then you found out it didn't exist, and you were given a very philosophical explanation for it, how would you have reacted, Ragini?
See, if I had to take permission from my king to go and travel, and then somebody was telling me this, I'm guessing if he came back empty-handed, that might have had repercussions.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, maybe, you know, the way you'd pitch it is, oh, I don't have the magic cop-surviving herb, but guess what? I've got this book.
I have something to make you less stupid.
Yeah.
I would spin whatever story it took at that point. But anyway, from here, so basically this has been the journey of the Panchatantra, which honestly for me has been the most interesting part to research for this entire episode, because I really until now did not know. I mean, I've read it, I've grown up on the Panchatantra. It is, you know, it's so commonplace that I could read a story anyway and be like, it sounds like a Panchatantra story. And it's just so like, it's such a, like it's just there. It's a part of our upbringing.
Yeah.
But to just read it from this context really blew my mind a little bit.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing story.
Yeah, it's quite awe-inspiring, right?
Like, yeah. Have you heard about this fairy tale called the Tallow Candle?
No.
So the story tells of a little candle that is dirtied by life and misunderstood, which eventually finds happiness after a tinderbox sees the good at its heart and lights it. So it sounds like any good old fairy tale that has a super saccharine sweet beginning and ending.
Yeah.
So this story was written by Hans Christian Andersen. He was a Danish writer, and if you don't know about him, please just Google him. He's a prolific writer of fairy tales and adapter of fairy tales. So it was written in the 1820s, and what is unique about it is that it was discovered as his first ever short story that he wrote that could have qualified as a fairy tale. And even the discovery was by pure chance. It was discovered by a local historian in Denmark in a place called Funen. And his name was Esben. But it was discovered in the family archives of this family called the Plum family. They have, the archive itself is amazing. But Esben stumbled across a small piece of yellowing paper at the bottom of a box, and he realized that it might be important. And Esben is a true professional, because the only way he knew it would be important was that he recognized the signature on it, and it was Hans Christian Andersen's.
Wow. Impressive.
Yeah, so apparently the story was written when he was relatively younger. He was at school, and it was probably written between 1822 and 1826. And he actually started writing published works, or he started being published only in 1829. So it was quite a bit earlier than his most famous work. And he went on to write hundreds of stories, but this could have been the beginning of all of that. So I like the comments that this lady called Sarah Maitland had about this story. She's written a book called Gossip from the Forest, which explores the connections between forests and fairy tales. And she says that the story is extremely Andersen. It's very, very Andersen, she says. It's highly moralistic, rather sentimental, and it's animating an inanimate object. That's very Andersen. I don't know anyone else who does it that way, which is great. That's a nice thing to say. Thank you, Sarah, from Andersen.
Okay.
And then she says, she found it very, quote, very interesting, but he obviously got better at his job, which is very refreshing. I'm sure it would have meant more at the time. For every child who woke in the night, someone would have lit a candle, or they would have stayed in the dark. We don't look at the candle as a source of light anymore. It would have been a more meaningful story then, but I don't think it's very good.
Oh, God, Sarah.
Okay, so she doesn't mince her words, clearly. So, yeah, so that's the story of how Andersen's, you know, first short story of a fairy tale was discovered.
And then shot down.
And then shot down by Sarah Maitland. Everybody go check out her book, please. So this isn't the only discovery. So this discovery is quite a bit older. It was in 2012, which is, it feels like it was yesterday, but it's 11 years ago now. No, it's not. I'm bad at math. But it's 9 years ago now. It might seem like yesterday, but it's nine, almost a decade ago. But around the same time, there was also a stash of 500 new fairy tales, which were locked away in an archive in Germany that were discovered after 150 years of them being there. And so these tales, they're part of a collection of myths, legends, and fairy tales. They're gathered by a local historian who operated mainly between 1810 and 1886 called Franz Xaver von Schönwirth. And so Franz...
Well done.
Because I'm on first name.
Well done on that pronunciation. Well, very impressed.
So because we're on first name terms, I'm going to call him Franz. So Franz is an interesting human being. He operated around the same time as the Grimm brothers, and he did something similar to them, which was collect these fairy tales, folk tales, legends, but he didn't put a spin on them. The Grimm brothers were famously known to have put a religious aspect into all of their fairy tales that had a very defined idea of good and bad and moral, what was moral and what was immoral. He just told them as they were. And so he just recorded them and he didn't influence them, as far as we know, in any perceivable way. In 1885, Jacob Grimm said this about him: "Nowhere in the whole of Germany is anyone collecting folklore so accurately, thoroughly, and with such a sensitive ear." And this is also something he told the king of Bavaria, that the only person who could replace him in his and his brother's work was Franz. Good old Franzy boy.
What?
Yeah. This researcher called Eichensier was sifting through von Schönwirth's work, Franz's work, and she discovered the 500 fairy tales. And a lot of them don't appear in other European fairy tale collections. So, shall I give you an example?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
So, apparently there's this story about a maiden who escapes a witch by transforming herself into a pond. The witch then lies on her stomach and drinks all the water, swallowing the young girl, who then uses a knife to cut her way out of the witch.
Ooh.
So that's a fairy tale.
Wow.
If you want to terrify your children.
It's a fairy tale, to be fair. Yeah.
So I haven't heard of that one at all. Not that I've heard of all the fairy tales.
Yeah,
in the
same.
World, but that's completely alien. And then it also, obviously, it includes all the usual versions of Cinderella and Rumpelstiltskin and things like that. But it has little nuggets like this young maiden, water maiden, who knows how to wield a knife, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, it was great forethought to actually first go convert yourself into a water body, then make sure that you have a knife while you're doing that.
Was the knife also water? These are all questions that you don't ask, I think, of fairy tales. Note to self, don't try to punch holes in fairy tales. You will win. Yeah. Good old Franz's legacy, it counts as one of the most significant collections in the German-speaking world. And they have actually started to try and translate them using a Munich-based English translator. And this was, again, like I said, it's quite an old story. And when I looked it up, they have translated them. And we'll provide you with the link in the blog post to the translated work.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that, actually.
Yeah.
That would be interesting. Speaking of gory fairy stories.
Mm-hmm.
So we had done a previous episode where, you know, we've done one of our BRF shots on us is on fairy tale. And you should go check that out because we've actually covered a lot of the true origins behind a bunch of stories, fairy stories in that one.
Yeah.
However, there's one that I specifically saved for this episode because it's just amazingly fascinating and it just deserved a full segment to itself. This is the real story of Bluebeard. Now, for those of you who don't know, do you know the story of Bluebeard?
Vaguely.
I'm sure you do.
Yes.
It was vague for me as well, and I had to kind of like refresh my memory.
Yeah.
But I did that successfully, and I'm going to pass on the knowledge. The story of Bluebeard is that he was this really wealthy and powerful person who had been married several times, and his wives just mysteriously disappeared. And then one day he goes to visit his neighbor, and he says that he wants to marry one of his daughters, and they're all terrified. Eventually, the youngest daughter sort of volunteers to be his wife. And, you know, when he takes her back to his chateau, he leaves for a couple of days and he gives her the keys to the house and says that you can go to, you know, do what you want, chill. But there's this one room that you just shouldn't enter.
Uh-oh.
And of course, like every good heroine, she does exactly what he's told her not to and enters the room. And when she enters the room, she finds it like it's full of blood and corpses of his ex-wives. And she realizes that he basically kills his wives.
Oof.
And then eventually, long story short, he comes back. He finds out she manages to trick him. And eventually he is killed and she moves on to live a happy and healthy life or whatever it was back in the day.
Oh, cool.
But, succinct end. Charles Perrault wrote Bluebeard. Mm-hmm. And Charles Perrault is also, you know, along with the Grimm brothers and Hans Christian Andersen, is one of the big names in the fairy tale industry. So the true story of Bluebeard is actually way more fascinating. It actually has a lot of contemporary connotation, like a little bit of an extension into contemporary times as well, which I will come to.
Mm.
But he bases his accounts on, there are two stories of two accounts that he could possibly have based this on. One is a really savage ruler in the 6th century in Brittany in France. The second account is far more detailed, actually, and this is around a nobleman called Jules de Rais. The French pronounce it slightly differently. Jules de Rais is actually was a French serial killer who was known to have murdered hundreds of children.
Oh.
So there is actually conjecture around whether he was actually a victim of a trial or whether he was actually the perpetrator of the crime.
Okay.
But we know Jules de Rais as he was a leader in the French army. He was also a companion to Joan of Arc. And in time, he fought alongside Joan of Arc against the English and during the Hundred Years' War. And after which he was appointed the Marshal of France. So he sort of grew in stature around this time. And in 1434, he retired from military life. And then sort of, you know, he became extremely flamboyant and would like really spend tons of money on like theater and would, you know, sort of creating these spectacles.
Mm.
And slowly got, you know, I think he just attracted a lot of attention to himself and was eventually accused of dabbling in the occult.
Oh.
In time, he was then accused of engaging in a series of child murders and with victims going possibly into the hundreds. The killings came to an end in 1440. And when he had a particularly violent dispute with a clergyman in the area, and that led to an investigation that brought the crimes to light. He was eventually found guilty, he was condemned to death, and he was hanged in 1440. And he was given the nickname Bluebeard because when he was in battle, his horse's sleek fur used to look blue in the sunlight. So he was called Bluebeard, and so that's where Bluebeard could possibly be come from.
Yeah. Do we know without a doubt that he did them, or do we not know?
No, we don't. There's a great possibility, according to scholars now, that this could have been an act of revenge by the Catholic Church or the French state. Because after he was hanged, the Duke of Brittany was given the authority to prosecute and received all the titles of his former lands and then distributed them amongst his own noblemen.
Wow.
And in 1992, Rais was retried during a media event in France. It wasn't a proper judicial trial, but there was a lawyer who made a long plea at a UNESCO amphitheater in May 1992, and then in, you know, pleading for his innocence, or for the case to be retried particularly. In November 1992, he organized a self-proclaimed court at the Luxembourg Palace, and he basically then proceeded to re-examine all of the source material and evidence made available at the trial back in the medieval times when he was tried. A team consisting of lawyers, writers, former French ministers, parliament members, a biologist and a medical doctor, presided over by a judge, found him not guilty. However, it is good to note that none of the people who sort of sat in on this trial were medieval historians by profession, and nor was any advice sought from any medical historian. So there is a little bit of a gap.
A giant hole. A cannonball-sized hole.
So the hearing pronounced Jules de Rais not guilty of the crimes and was then converted into a partially fictionalized biography called The Mouth of the Wolf. It was narrated by the writer Gilbert Prothero, who was also leading the trial, the mock trial that they ran for him the non-official trial that they ran for him in November 1992.
Mm.
And they did say that the case for his innocence is very, very strong. No child's corpse was ever found at his castle, and he appears to have confessed to escape excommunication. The accusations appear to be false charges made up by powerful rival lords to benefit from the confiscation of his lands.
Greedy dogs.
Yeah. And so basically it's like this, you know, he could have been, he couldn't have been, but regardless of what he did inspire a story that has
terrified children for years.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if we went to all the trials that were conducted during the Inquisition or during whatever period in history and went and retried all these individuals? Jeez. Coming to psychological conditions that are named for fairy tale characters, specifically Disney characters, but obviously most of Disney's whole content machine, especially when they first started out, was taking from folktales, legends, fairy tales, and all these cultural stories that were, you know, that have been around for eons. So,
and then printing it up and
animating it. Yeah. So, have you heard of Peter Pan syndrome?
Is it a man-child syndrome?
Yes, sort of. It's just characterized.
Oh, yay, well done.
It's characterized. You can make an educated guess, can't you? Because based on the, it's very close to what the character itself went through. It's characterized by emotional immaturity and an unwillingness to take on responsibilities. It's more common in men, sorry, men, than in women. But women can suffer from something called Wendy syndrome, which is acting like mothers to their partners and others. Did not know that.
Ouch. Okay.
You know, it's like when you study psychology at any point in your life, you actually go through this condition where you assume or think that you have all of the psychological conditions that you're studying because you've...
I wonder if doctors have that when they study. Like, I wonder if medical students have that when they're studying.
Oh, God. Can you imagine living hell? Because imagine if you had something called Sleeping Beauty Syndrome.
Does that mean that you just sleep all the time?
Well, actually, it's an actual neurological disorder. It's called Klein-Levin Syndrome, and it's characterized by periods of excessive sleep and altered behavior. So a patient can become very drowsy and sleeps for the majority of the day and night, and they'll only wake up to go to the bathroom or to eat. And sometimes they can last up to months at a time.
Actually, that sounds like a really good life.
Oh, God. Sounds terrible.
To sleep.
I think there is a story of a young girl who went through this. We will post it in the blog post if you would like to go through it. Going from that to a slightly unsettling one called the Rapunzel syndrome. Do you want to have a guess, Ragini?
You'd never cut your hair? Okay. Is this like Stockholm syndrome?
No, it's not. So it's an actual thing apparently where it's an intestinal condition that results from people eating hair. So Rapunzel syndrome happens as a result of someone having trichophagia, which is you swallow your hair and you swallow so much of it. I know. You swallow so much of it that over the course of years, the hair accumulates, resulting in a giant hairball in the stomach or small intestine.
Why aren't you just pooping it out, though?
Because you eat that much of it that it just becomes like a solidified ball. And it can be dangerous, obviously, apart from the obvious reasons of a huge thing, a foreign object inside your body. It can also wrap around your organs and cause perforations.
Ooh.
Because apparently, people can't digest human hair. So.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's extremely rare. So
that's something new to learn.
Everybody stop panicking. It's extremely rare. Only about 24 cases have been reported. And yeah, don't look up the hairball, please. For your own good. Just don't.
Okay.
Two interesting ones are the Bambi complex and the Cinderella complex. The Bambi complex is people affected by it. They're very sentimental and sympathetic towards wildlife and wild animals. I'm sure everybody's relating here. They usually have very strong feelings against hunting, control fires, or any other inhumane treatment of animals, especially cute ones like deer.
Aww.
Yeah, we're all just collectively believing we have it. which is also known as mass hypnosis. I'm not joking. So then the last one is the Cinderella complex, which, well, you know Cinderella. She's, you know, she's cooking and cleaning and being generally mistreated by her stepmother and stepsisters. Someone with the Cinderella complex is extremely dependent on men for emotional and financial purposes. This could be for a variety of reasons in terms of nature and nurture. You could have, you know, been abused, or you could have had certain things happen to you during your formative years that have caused you to be dependent on a male figure for both financial and emotional security. And it was coined apparently in 1981 by a lady called Colette Downing. And she wrote a book called The Cinderella Complex, Women's Hidden Fear of Independence. I tend to not like the insinuation that this exists, but I don't know, maybe it does.
I'm pretty sure it does.
Hmm. So those are some interesting psychological conditions based on fairy tale characters. And we all have one of them.
Yes.
Luckily, it's a good
or
one.
Two or three or four or five.
No hairballs, please. From psychological conditions to medical conditions. Okay, so this one is based on a paper called Medical Conditions Revealed in Fairy Tales, Folklore and Literature. And I'm given to think that the author, whose name is John Massey, he has good sense of humor. But I think it's a good sort of investigative piece because he basically picks fairy tales and then thinks about or postulates what these particular characters could have in terms of a medical condition. Let me give you a couple of examples. So there's Jack and the Giant Beanstalk. So I'm not going to go into the story again. Everybody knows the story of Jack and the Giant Beanstalk. But John Massey says, clearly, the giant has a pituitary tumor causing gigantism. The tumor pressing on his optic chiasm also affects his vision. So he can't see him. And that's why he says, fee-fi-fo-fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman. Yeah. So,
well done. You could do a voiceover. Very impressive.
So, next up in John Massey's Rolodex of medical conditions in fairy tales is Hansel and Gretel. So he says that they obviously wander off into the woods, and witches are very common in fairy tales, and they usually are described with warts and hunchback and generally unpleasant looking. And this, says John Massey, could be a reference to neurofibromatosis, the warts being cutaneous fibromas and the hunchback from scoliosis, a common complication of neurofibromatosis. So, oh, don't be mean to the witch. She just has medical conditions. Just be nice to her. And he adds that people with this condition may have been shunned by society and so live alone in remote locations, contributing to a somewhat selfish and nasty personality. Just, you know, from not being well socialized.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's quite a sympathetic
view. Yeah, it's very sympathetic to all the baddies. The next one is Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Oh, I love this one. So, everybody knows the story again, but he says it is clear that she has Klein-Levine syndrome, a disorder of gluttony.
Yeah, where she just goes into other people's houses and thinks, yes, that she can just take what she wants.
Yeah, but this is a bit, yeah, selfish also. So yeah, the two characteristics of Klein-Levine syndrome are hyperphagia, which is gluttony, and hypersomnolence, which is an excessive sleeping too much. So those are the two reasons that she steals and then falls asleep.
A grabby little girl.
Yes. And then he also says, because he's just that kind of guy, he gives you an alternative explanation that Goldilocks has Prader-Willi syndrome, which is associated with hyperphagia, obesity, low IQ, in brackets, entering a bear's house, behavioral issues, in brackets, breaking things, and can be associated with obstructive sleep apnea, which causes excessive tiredness. So, yeah, Goldilocks was a troubled little girl.
Why did he write this paper exactly?
I think, you know what, in the world, you have two types of people.
People like John Massey. People who take their jobs too seriously.
Yes.
And people like John Massey, you can just find a way to have fun with.
So the last one I'm going to do is Little Red Riding Hood, because this one was the most interesting to me. So clearly, says John, Little Red Riding Hood suffered from myopia, astigmatism, or both, because she does not notice that the grandma looks like a wolf. You know what John Massey does, though? He gives you an alternative theory for everything. Alternatively, the grandma may have had hypertrichosis. It's also known as werewolf syndrome, and it's characterized by excessive hair growth on various parts of a person's body. And she would have been hidden away from society because living in society would have been too traumatic with her condition. And she could have had many other issues. Grandmother, what big eyes you have. Exophthalmosis, says John Massey. Abnormal, which is an abnormal protrusion of the eyeball or eyeballs. What a deep voice you have. Vocal cord nodules, says John Massey. What big hands you have. Pituitary tumor, shouts John Massey.
So you know what we talked about, not punching holes in fairy tales? Because you will win.
Yeah, John Massey missed that note.
Exhibit A.
And that brings us to the end of this particular segment. Thank you, John. That was highly entertaining, but also a pretty good expansive knowledge of medical conditions.
None of which I will remember 5 minutes after.
Adding on to the bit about Goldilocks, there's a really interesting... do you know what the Goldilocks zone is?
I think I have a vague idea.
So the Goldilocks zone is... it refers to the habitable zone around the star where the temperature is just right. Not too hot, not too cold, for liquid water to exist on a planet. So it is, obviously, we get the reference about why it's called the Goldilocks zone now.
Yeah.
But finding any area in space that is able to sustain liquid water could potentially be life-bearing.
Mm.
Because the only life that we know about, you know, is our carbon-based life, and water plays a crucial role for our existence. So therefore, the natural exposition from here is that if we direct our attention to other planets where, you know, the locations are capable of having liquid water, there is a possibility that we may come across life there.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
That's why we look for water on Mars.
Yeah. Did they find water on Mars ever?
Let's not go into that. Yes, they did, but it was subterranean and it was something very scientific.
Looking for planets in the Goldilocks zone is a bait that allows scientists to hone in their search for Earth-like planets and that could potentially contain life. And the assumption is that if there is a possibility that there will be liquid water on the planet, then it is also a possibility that the planet may be habitable.
Mm.
And so, yeah, so a little bit from like, oh my God, from the psychology to medicine to science.
To astronomy.
And astronomy. It's just like smashing it.
Yeah, and we were surprised that the Panchatantra traveled from India to the Middle East. Like, look where else they got.
We're like... And with that, I'm going to come to the last segment of our episode, which is around the conventions of fairy tales. All right. So there are a bunch that we know about Once Upon a Time and a long, long, you know, in a faraway land and stuff like that. And those are pretty self-explanatory. So I'm not going to go into those too deeply because honestly, it's pretty much what we imagine it to be, which is just an orbit place in time and an orbit place on the planet.
Yeah.
But there is the fairy tale convention of they lived happily ever after is when for a long time and people described happily, like, you know, being happy ever after. So it was used in relation to marriage and it sort of, you know, it was about, you know, and therefore most fairy tales will end with two people getting married and then they lived happily ever after.
Yeah.
Right. The first time it was ever used in context to marriage was in Boccaccio's translation of the Demacheron. For those of you who don't know, the Demacheron is a book based, it was written in the 1700s, I think. And it is a collection of stories told by a group of people who moved to a little chateau on the outskirts of Florence to escape the Black Death. And they begin to swap stories with each other. In the 16th century, it sort of went as like happy in the ever after, which is before, you know, before Boccaccio wrote Demacheron. And so it sort of meant the eternal happiness that you would find for yourself in heaven. And then it eventually translated by the 18th century into being like happily ever after, meaning being together forever in wedded bliss. There is a really interesting essay by Tolkien, who Shar and I absolutely love. We are big fans of Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. But Tolkien wrote an essay called On Fairy Stories, in which he discusses the fairy story as a literary form. And he suggests that fairy stories can provide a moral or emotional consolation through their happy ending, which he terms as eucatastrophe.
What's that?
Which is basically a happy ending. Oh. In the more traditional sense. What I also really did try to find out, but I haven't been able to, is, you know, how does the term happy ending get the connotations that it sometimes has today, which is the slightly less, you know, the slightly more adulterated connotation. And I could find nothing about how it made that journey. So if anybody who's listening to this podcast knows about that, please write into us and tell us. That would be an interesting bit for us to know as well.
And with that, we have now reached the end of this episode. Would you say it's a happy ending, Ragini?
I'd say it's a very happy ending.
Okay, before we crack any more dirty puns, we'll see you next time. Thank you for listening.
Yes, and in the meantime, if you've enjoyed the episode, please review, share, subscribe. It really, really helps us. We will see you soon with another word.
See you.
Bye, guys. Okay, that's it for today. The episode you just heard was edited by Mohit Chandilya. Music for the episode is by Charitha Arora. If you'd like to reach out to us about the podcast, the episode, or you just want to say hi in general, we're on Instagram as Barely Research Facts. You could also come to the website at www.artnowdoes.in. If you like the podcast, review, subscribe, and please share it with other podcast lovers in your circles. It would mean so much to us. Until next time, bye.